This is kind of a nice little field trip we get to go on this morning. But yeah, this is the fellowship hall where All Things New meets. And they are a church plant of a few years old. And they meet here at 9 o'clock. And it's pretty cool that we get to share this space with them. And they've warmed it for us with their own body heat. And the furnace is working. And I am thankful for that. This morning, we're going to finish Ruth chapter 4. And I want to begin with a question. How do we make sense of our lives? How do we make sense of our lives, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the painful? How do we make sense of it all? I remember, as I think back on my own life, there are several painful parts. I remember one in particular. It was about 10 years ago, and I had a potato chip route. It sounds weird, but I sold Tim's potato chips. You guys familiar with Tim's potato chips? It's like the competitor to Kettle brand. I sold those, and I hated it. I did not enjoy it. It's a long story about how I got into that position, but suffice it to say, I was driving a box truck around selling deep-fried potatoes, and I didn't like it. And I remember one particular moment. I was driving down I-5, and it was at the end of the day, and I was driving to another store, and I was just angry, and I was sad, and the tears just kind of flowed. And I remember praying to God, I don't like this, I don't want to be here, and lament seemed to be kind of like my native tongue in that moment. It was a rough season. I could say that I was depressed and frustrated, but looking back, it was one of the most fortunate times of my life, and I'll tell you why at the end. I'll hold you in suspense, but it was one of the most cherished times of my life when I look back on it, and I'll tell you why later. Professional photographers have many different kinds of lenses that they use, their tools. Right? Sometimes they use lenses that allow you to zoom in and to get really close. Others, like a wide-angle lens, they offer a bigger picture. And photographers need both. For our own lives, we need both. When you think on your life, are you able to have that kind of wide-angle lens? And to not get sucked into the anxiety and the pain of the present moment, to not become myopic, but are you able to have that wide-angle lens and hopefully see what God has been doing behind the scenes? And as we close out the book of Ruth this morning, that's my encouragement to you, is to try to have this wide-angle lens and suspend judgment on your painful moments right now, because who knows what they'll be in the future? Who knows what God will use? Sometimes an accurate representation of your present moment is not feasible, right? You might be going through some really painful and difficult things, and it's hard to accurately assess the situation. And so I ask you to suspend judgment on that. And we can, as the adage goes, hindsight is 20/20, right? Mm-hmm. When we look back, then we can see God's faithfulness. I'm actually too hot now.
It's wonderful.
It's amazing. God, thank you for heat. So in hindsight, we see God's faithfulness. I believe that this is true for each of your stories. It's true for my story. And it's true for Ruth and Naomi as well, as we close out the book of Ruth. And I hope that you're excited. I'm excited. Ruth is an amazing book. And so if you have your Bibles, go ahead and open to Ruth chapter 4. Just by way of quick summary, Brianna had the privilege of preaching last Sunday, and she preached on Ruth chapter 3. Ruth chapter 3 took place on the threshing floor. Chapter 4, it moves to the city gates. We're going to talk about that in a moment, but that is important. Chapter 3 took place in the most private of spaces. Chapter 4 is going to take place in the most public of space. Chapter 3 involved the secrecy of night. Chapter 4 involves the openness of day. I love this kind of juxtaposition between chapters 3 and chapter 4. In chapter 3, we also saw that Boaz and Ruth, they maintained their integrity. And at the end of chapter 3, Boaz tells Ruth he's going to make sure that they're taken care of. And so now, in chapter 4, we're going to look at how Boaz is going to set about to accomplish this, okay? So first, I want to talk about city gates, because this is important to the story. There's a reason why he meets at the city gates. The city gate was the place where the civil and domestic disputes were resolved. So it was kind of like the courtroom. This is why the prophet Amos says in chapter 5, verse 10, establish justice in the city gate, because the city gate was the source and foundation of decisions for the town and for the people. Okay? Moreover, the city gates were also the most public of spaces. Anybody walking by could become privy to that conversation, right? If you wanted to have a private conversation, you're not going to do it at the city gates, because everybody's going to take notice and hear what you are saying, right? So it's really important. This is where Boaz meets, and we're going to find out in the rest of the story why he decides to do this here. So we're going to read chapter 4, starting in verse 1. It says this: Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat there, just as the guardian redeemer he had mentioned came along. Boaz said, "Come over here, my friend, and sit down." So he went over and sat down. Now, listen to this. Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, "Sit here." And they did so, right? So Boaz has grabbed the guardian redeemer. He's also grabbed 10 of the most honorable people in the town. There's two things that I want to highlight out of this small portion of scripture. One is the relative's name. Actually, more accurately, the lack of his name. In Hebrew, it is Peloni Almoni, which it's not a name. It's like Mr. So-and-so. But in the book of Ruth, have you noticed how important names are? This guy's not even given a name. The reason why is because we know that he is the guardian redeemer. His job was to take care of Ruth and Naomi. Is he taking care of Ruth and Naomi? No. Ruth and Naomi should have been in his guest bedroom, but instead, they're having to make it work. So I find it really interesting that in a book where names are really important and names are a matter of character and highlighting somebody, this guy's not even given a name. He's just Mr. So-and-so, or like, Mr. Who really cares, right? So he's not being a guardian redeemer. The Hebrew word for guardian redeemer is goel. Can you say that with me? Goel. So technically he was the goel, but he wasn't goeling. He wasn't doing it. So when we talk about this term, this is the second thing I want to highlight, is this term goel. It's come up before and I've pushed pause on it until we get to here. And I want to talk about this idea of guardian redeemer. This term goel. You might have heard it called kinsman redeemer, and that's true. I do think that guardian redeemer and kinsman redeemer, that they've kind of become like Christianese. And when I say Christianese, like other examples are like, I'm on fire for the Lord. Not necessarily a bad statement, but like, if you were to tell a non-Christian, like, I'm on fire for the Lord, they'd be like, are you okay? Like, or like, I'm having my quiet time with Jesus. Like, There's language that we adopt within the Christian subculture that is helpful for us, but I think sometimes what it can do is it can, like, devoid it of meaning. And I think kinsman redeemer can do this when we talk about it that way. And so I'm going to refer to it as goel. And I want to look at goel in the context of the Bible. And I'm going to provide two examples for that. One is in Genesis 4. You don't have to turn there. I'm just going to summarize it for you. In Genesis 14... Abraham's nephew, Lot, he pitches a tent near Sodom, okay? Not a great choice for obvious reasons, right? Sodom and Gomorrah. But he pitches his tent there before it's destroyed. He doesn't know it's going to be destroyed, but it is. He pitches his tent there. He sets up home, okay? In chapter 14, there's a skirmish between some local kings, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah lose. What this means for Lot is that him and his family are taken as spoils for war. The spoils of war. They're like the booty, right? And so they're taken. Now, we're in the context of a Goel, right? So who is the Goel for Lot? Abraham. Abraham is the Goel for Lot. So what does Abraham do? He suits up for battle. And he's going to go fight the kings who just won to get back his nephew. Does he want to do that? I don't know. He doesn't have a choice, though. He is the Goel. I thought of Liam Neeson from Taken, right? I have a particular set of skills. Anybody seen that movie? Right? Like, he, is, in my mind, is Liam Neeson. And so he's going to go save his family. And he doesn't have a particular set of skills. He has a particular set of responsibilities to save his kin. Okay, and so what we need to understand with the Goel is that they risk life and limb to save their brother. That's the first example. The second example is from the book of Hosea, if you're familiar. It's a minor prophet. Hosea is told by Yahweh to marry a prostitute, and he does, and he becomes her bet-off, right? And the bet-off was the place of safety and security and provision for the woman and the women in the household. Okay, so he marries Gomer, who is a prostitute, and old habits die hard. Gomer goes back to prostitution. She ends up in bad straits, and she ends up at the city gate being sold. Now, who is her Goel? Hosea, by marriage, right? He is her bet-off. And so what does he have to do? He has to do whatever he can to get her back. He liquidates everything to get back the one he loves. But Goel says, whatever it takes, this one is mine. I'm going to risk life and limb to save you. I'm going to liquidate all my assets to save you. That's what a Goel is. Okay? So a Goel does whatever they have to ensure the safety of their kin. And you can see that this is more than a theological definition. This is a way of life. And it is a way of life that comes at a high cost for the Goel. And it had very real repercussions for that family and for the Goel. And so, as we've talked about, Naomi had a Goel. It's Mr. So-and-so. And so Boaz speaks to Mr. So-and-so in verse 3. He says this. Let's look at the text. And he said to the Goel, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me so I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I'm next in line. And the Goel says, I will redeem it. So what Boaz is describing here is just like a standard transfer of land. It's a small claims court deal. It's mentioned in Leviticus 25, and the purpose of the sale is to keep the land within the family. Okay? That's the purpose of this sale. And so Mr. So-and-so, Pelony Alimony, he agrees to buy it. Because, right, who doesn't want more land to farm and more produce, all the sorts of things? But notice something. Notice what Boaz has not mentioned, or who he has not mentioned.
It's a trap.
He hasn't mentioned Ruth and Naomi. And that's strategic. He's setting this dude up. He's doing it in the most public place with the 10 most honorable men so that he can make sure Ruth and Naomi are cared for. Because in an honor-shame culture, this is a big deal. It's a big deal. We don't really live in an honor-shame culture. Probably the closest thing that we have to honor-shame culture is being blasted on social media. And if you're a middle schooler or high schooler and you're on social media, you get it. But we don't live in an honor-shame culture. This is a big deal for him to set him up this way. So verse 5, then Boaz said, on the day you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead man with his property. So Boaz is gaming the system in order to care for Ruth and Naomi. And what he's doing is he's combining two laws. We talked about two laws at the very beginning of the series. One is the inalienable land law. That's the one I just mentioned. That's Leviticus 25. That keeps the land in the family line. The other one that he's combining is the levirate law. Now, the levirate law says that if a wife becomes a widow, if her husband dies, it is the responsibility of the brother to provide a male heir so that she can be taken care of. He is combining these two laws. Because the reality of this situation is Ruth's situation is kind of a gray area. There's three things that could have happened in this conversation. One, Mr. So-and-so, he says, okay, I'll take both. I'll take both the land and I'll take both Ruth and Naomi. He could say, no, I don't want that. You take it. Those are both great. The third option is he could say, no, I just want the land. I don't care about the women. Because the land is an asset. The women are a liability, right? They're more mouths to feed. He technically could have done that. And so Boaz knows that. He knows the Torah. And he understands his culture. And he's going to do what all that is within his power to care for the vulnerable within his society. And so he steps up and he puts this dude in a really tough spot to make a decision. So he doesn't... Brianna talked about this last week. The book of Ruth is not a love story. The book, at least not in the way that we think about it, but it's a story of redemption. And it's a story of God's love for us. This is what it looks like. This is when God says that he redeems us. He is goelding us. But it's not a love story as we typically think about it. Boaz doesn't necessarily care if he marries Ruth. He just wants to make sure they're taken care of. And if Mr. So-and-so does it, great. If not, great. So Boaz is using social pressure in an honor-shame culture. Okay. He does this in the city gates where it's most public, right? So if Mr. So-and-so, he decides he doesn't want it. We're going to read this in verse 6. At this, the Goel said, then I cannot redeem it, because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it for yourself. I cannot do it. And one of the reasons why is the firstborn son of Ruth would belong to Elimelech's line. The land would then become his. There are more mouths to feed. It's a liability. Verse 7. Now, in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel. Okay, that's just their custom. Verse 8. So the guardian redeemer said to Boaz, buy it yourself. And he removed his sandal. The book of Ruth is about doing the right thing and doing the right thing by others. When you think about righteousness, that is what it means, to do right by others. It is a social concept. And sometimes doing the right thing costs you. And this guy didn't want to do that. And as a result, we know him as Peleni Elmeni. But Boaz, he does something different. Let's read verse 9 and 10. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. Today you are witnesses. Woo! Yeah. Celebration. Two movies came to mind when I thought of this. One, I'm sorry, but it's Pride and Prejudice, you know? When, what's his name? Mr. Darcy. You know, he starts walking up in the morning dew. All the girls probably know this scene, what I'm talking about. Right? The music swells. You're like, oh, they're finally going to be together. It's going to be okay. The other scene is, this is more of like my style of movie. It's a Marvel reference in Avengers Endgame when Tony Stark, he has the gauntlet and he snaps his fingers. It's like that moment where everything is going to be okay. That's the point of the story right now. Ruth and Naomi are going to be cared for. The problem is solved. Verses 11 and 12. To me, these are like the ending scene in a musical. The whole town comes out. It says, then the elders and all the people at the gate, they said, or we could say they sung, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the family of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. A few things of note. Rachel and Leah, they're the two most honored women in all of Israel. That's a pretty big deal. They're putting her at that status. Second, the NIV says, may you have standing. But if you've been a part of the series, what word are they using there instead of standing? Chayil. It's more Hebrew wordplay. So when they say that, may you have chayil, may you have fame, may you have wealth, may you have prestige, may you have honor, may you have character. Moreover, Ephrathah comes from the Hebrew word parah, which means to bear fruit. And Tamar, as we learned last week, is an example of chayil too, in a very similar situation. So there's so much imagery going on in these two verses. The townspeople are saying things like, may you be famous, may you be fruitful, may you gain chayil, for you are a woman of chayil like Tamar. Verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. Verse 13 is the closing montage of the movie. Everything is made right. There is shalom, that feeling of, it's going to be good. Ruth, who was barren for 10 years, now has a baby. Interestingly, this is the only time God's direct involvement is ever mentioned in the text. For 10 years, she had not been able to bear a child, but God makes her able. Moreover, how is Ruth referred to in this passage? Just Ruth. She's not Ruth the Moabite anymore. The identity that she has had for the first three chapters is gone. She's no longer Ruth the Moabite. She is just Ruth. So this is the closing montage, but there's one more scene. In my study of Ruth, I came across this quote. It's by Jonathan Dick. He says, the reading the ending first is simply a shortcut to a critical reading of the text. What does this mean? It means the ending shapes the story. The ending shapes everything that has come before and invites us to see things in a different light. So what's the ending? Let me read it for you. If you have your Bible, you can read along. Verse 14, the woman said to Naomi, praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout all Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you, Naomi, in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, Naomi, and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth. Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. The women living there said, Naomi has a son. Who is this about?
The baby.
Not quite. The baby is super important. The baby is actually another guardian redeemer. There's three guardian redeemers in Ruth. Fun fact. Naomi. Centers on Naomi. Yeah. Who does the story end with? It doesn't end with Ruth. It ends with Naomi. This is part of this is Naomi's story. You could say that Naomi is the center of the story. Her bitter beginnings and pleasant endings. Every character is related to Naomi. And so, I don't have it here because we're not in the cold sanctuary, but as my sermon slide, I have it as an elderly woman. That's Naomi, in my mind, right? Naomi is, in some respects, the central character. The book of Ruth is about Naomi's relationship with God. The book of Ruth is about God caring for a widow, for an elderly widow. And it shows us that Yahweh cares for the orphan, the widow, and the stranger. Consider the plot. Everything is reversed. The plot begins with her empty. It ends with her full. She now holds the third kinsman redeemer in the story. You had Mr. So-and-so Boaz, and now this child, she holds the kinsman redeemer, the Goel, in her hands. She was bitter. She changed her name tomorrow. Now she is Naomi again. The townsmen who welcomed her back with sadness and grief now rejoice with her. The book started with a famine, and it ends with a harvest. This is shalom, and this feels like the end. But just like any good Marvel movie, there's a post-credit scene. Let's look at the last half of verse 17. I ended it early on purpose. And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. This, then, is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Amminadab. Amminadab, the father of Nashon. Nashon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz. Boaz, the father of Obed. Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of David. So why the genealogy? Say it like this. It is the proverbial nail in the coffin. What do I mean by that? The book of Ruth is a story about a controversial ethic. The ethic is the ethic of inclusion, of including the outsider. That Ruth, who is the outsider, is made an insider. And the genealogy has a point for the author. And David is named for a very practical reason. So let me ask you a question. Who was the greatest king of Israel?
David.
Let me ask you another question. Why do we even have David? Because of Ruth, the Moabite.
Could you tell us what Obed means?
I actually don't know.
I looked it up and I forgot it.
It probably comes from servant, avad. Actually, yes. It is avad, servant.
Okay.
So why do we even have David? It's because of Moabite. The Israelite author is making a point. And he's making the strongest point he can make. Because he's hearkening back to David, who is like the coup de grace of Israel. That we wouldn't even have David if somebody hadn't stepped in and included Ruth the Moabite. If Israel didn't welcome the ultimate outsider, Israel never would have had the ultimate insider. Without Ruth, there'd be no David. And so let's expand on this from a Christian perspective. If we didn't have Ruth, and we didn't have Boaz, and their actions of integrity, who would we not have?
Jesus.
Jesus comes from the line of David. Matthew 1. This is a record of the ancestors of Jesus, a descendant of David. The Israelite author is making a point, and he's doing it with all of his might. If it were not for Ruth, we wouldn't have Jesus. You never know what one small act of Hayil can achieve. And so Ruth and her tremendous courage and integrity brought redemption for Naomi, brought redemption for that small town, brought redemption for the nation of Israel and King David, and brought redemption for the whole world in Jesus. When Naomi looked back on her life, she could see God's hand. When she looked through that wide-angle lens, she could see how God was working. That's true for our life as well. Now, I'd like to finish this morning with the rest of the story that I started earlier. Me and my crazy potato chip route. I slung potato chips. I didn't like it. The only saving grace was my dad. My dad had retired years earlier, and he started joining me on my rides. Man, I vowed that I would not cry. He would help me load stuff up into the box truck. And he would ride along with me, and he would help me put stuff on the shelves. That job gave me a unique and special time with my father. I look back on it, I couldn't have had that any other way. Because I literally worked alongside my dad. At the time, my parents had 5 acres. And so I would park my truck there in the evenings. At the end of a particular day, I remember having this weird thought. I remember it clear as day, and it was so strange. Looking back, I think it was the Holy Spirit. I remember Brianna was in the car, and I was pulling out, and I waved to my dad, and I remember thinking, I wonder if this will be my last summer with my dad. It was. My dad, shortly thereafter, died of a brain aneurysm. Just like completely took us all by surprise. So why do I tell you that story? I don't tell you for the sake of sympathy, but I tell you to reevaluate your history and even to suspend judgment on your present circumstances. That look for the fingerprints of God in your life. Slinging potato chips sucked. I hated every moment of it, but there was no other way that I could have worked 40 hours a week alongside my dad. That was a gift. That was a gift. So if we could gain a few lessons from the book of Ruth, that would be one. In your life, have a wide angle lens. I know that your present moment may suck, just like it sucked for me slinging potato chips. Suspend your present judgment. You have no idea what God may or may not be doing in your present moment. Look for God's fingerprints in your story. One of the things as a spiritual director that I've been trained to do is you look for the light. It's very easy for us to look for the dark in our lives. News doesn't help. Social media doesn't help with that. Just our own proclivities doesn't help with that. But look for the light, because that's where the Holy Spirit's at work. Another lesson, if you're in a painful time, don't give up. It's not the end. This season may be bitter. It may be Mara. It may be awful. It may feel empty. You may feel empty. But know this. God sees and God cares. We see that from the book of Ruth. And perhaps this season is necessary for some reason that you don't currently know. And maybe you will never know. Consider Ruth and Naomi. They never saw David. They certainly never saw Jesus. A third lesson. Normal people can change the world. They can change the world simply by living normal lives with integrity. As an insider or outsider, it doesn't matter. Ruth came into town insignificant, but her courage and integrity brought about redemption, ultimately for the whole world. There's a reason why Ruth is juxtaposed to the book of Judges, right? We looked just really briefly at the beginning of the sermon series about how the book of Judges, there's a common refrain, right? What is it? Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. In the book of Ruth, 3 insignificant people did what was right in God's eyes. And they forever change the course of history. This is a quote by Sandra Richter. All of eternity is changed by sacrificial integrity. It only takes a faithful few in the midst of a depraved generation. And the big story of God is lived out through the little stories of our lives. That cosmic redemption happens in suburban streets. Streets that are eerily similar to the streets that you and I walk each and every day. You are not insignificant. Your acts are not insignificant. Your character is not insignificant. Consider 2 more things. First, prayer. Has anybody noticed how prayer is used throughout this book? It's really interesting. It's subtle, but it's there. And I'm just going to read some examples. Ruth 1, 8 through 9. Naomi prays for her daughters-in-law that they will be blessed. Is that answered? Ruth is blessed. Ruth 2, 11 through 12, Boaz prays that God might reward Ruth, that she would find safety and security. Is that prayer answered?
Yes.
Yes. These are all the prayers. Ruth 2:20, Naomi prays for Boaz that he might receive God's blessing. Is that prayer answered?
Yes.
Yes. Ruth 3:10, Boaz prays for Ruth that she might receive God's blessing.
Yeah.
Ruth 4:11 through 12, the townspeople pray for Ruth and Boaz that they might be fertile and prosperous and that she might have fame throughout Israel. Mm-hmm. Answered. Ruth 4:14 through 15, the women of the town pray for Obed that his name might live on in perpetuity. Is that prayer answered?
Yeah.
Pretty stinking cool. And how does God answer the prayers? He answers the prayers through the people. And we see this interplay between God's divine will and man's choice. And this is how we see God work it out in our lives as we go about our day. The cumulative effect of these prayers is to point to God's behind-the-scenes control of the whole narrative. That's Peter Lau. He wrote a book on the book of Ruth. And so here's the lesson. You are more powerful than you think, or should I say that your prayers are more powerful than you think, and your character is more powerful than you think. Always remember that your chayil is power and that God can do marvelous things with simple obedience. 2 Chronicles 16:9. I've mentioned it so many times. I feel like it's becoming my life verse. It says this, "For the eyes of the Lord move to and fro, seeking to strongly support those who are fully His." And with that, we close out the book of Ruth.